شهر الطاعة والإيمان، شهر الرحمة والغفران، شهر الطاعة والإيمان، شهر الرحمة والغفران.
أيامك خير الأيام
يا رمضان،
يا شهر صيام وقيام
يا رمضان.
أيامك خير الأيام
يا رمضان،
يا شهر صيام وقيام
يا رمضان.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين. سلام عليكم ورحمة الله. I would first like to offer my congratulations and felicitations on the auspicious occasion of the birth anniversary of the second holy successor to the Holy Messenger of Islam, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam. And I've been asked to speak about the Holy Imam for a few minutes for you brothers and sisters. And one can speak a lot in relation to the second Imam. But I've been asked to speak in relation to the so-called Treaty of Reconciliation, which is one of the pivotal aspects in the life of the Holy Imam, or in practical terms, the forced truce which Imam Hassan had to make with Muawiyah. So, inshallah, with your permission, I'm going to speak in this regard for half an hour or more, inshallah. The political climate inherited by Imam Hassan alayhi salam deserves some acknowledgement, because it has a very important role in relation to the running of affairs which followed after the martyrdom of his father, Amirul Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam. Amirul Mu'mineen, his khilafah, his caliphate, lasted for around 5 years. And during these 5 years, three very important milestones in the form of wars or battles had been actualized. In the year 36 after Hijrah, the first battle during the caliphate of Amirul Mu'mineen was the Battle of Jamal, the Battle of the Camel. And here, Amirul Mu'mineen, his opponents and his adversaries are called the Naqithin, which means the covenant breakers. And here they're called the covenant breakers because they did pledge their allegiance to Amirul Mu'mineen. However, then they broke it. When did they break it? When they realized that they're going to have no share of authority, no share of the wealth during the caliphate of Amirul Mu'mineen. When they realized that, under the excuse of retaliating for the spilt blood of the third caliphate, or the third caliph, Uthman, they broke their covenant with Amirul Mu'mineen, the likes of Talha and Zubair and others. And this was a very ugly battle. More than 10,000 people were killed in less than, you know, a 1 or 2 day period, according to some reports. And so this happened in the first year of the caliphate of Amirul Mu'mineen. And these people were called the covenant breakers. Now, the Holy Messenger had prophesied this to Amirul Mu'mineen in one holy tradition where he said, سَتُقَاتِلُ بَعْدِي النَّاكِثِينَ وَالْقَاسِطِينَ وَالْمَارِقِينَ, that you will battle, You will wage war after me, the Holy Prophet, with these three groups. This was the first group, the Narkathin. And Ayesha was also active in this battle, and in the books of history from reliable Sunni scholars, earlier scholars, like in the 3rd century after Hijrah, such as Ibn Qutaybe, he recounts that the Holy Messenger had said that one of you wives, addressing his wives, the Holy Prophet said, one of you will encounter the barking of dogs in a place called Ho'ab. And then he addressed Ayesha saying, I hope it's not going to be you. Because whoever it was going to be, it was seen as something, as a disadvantage, as something which would be against the spirit of the Messenger of Islam. And when Ayesha was escorted to go towards Basra, where the Battle of Jamal took place, near about in Basra, there, on her way, she had encountered the barking of dogs. And even during the journey, she kept on asking, so where are we now? What's the name of this place? And when she encountered the barking of dogs, she said, let's go back. Once after realizing and being told this was Ho'ab, the district was Ho'ab, which was famous for its wells, she said, let's go back. But then her nephew, then with the help of 50 people, came and convinced her that we've passed Ho'ab. This is not Ho'ab officially. And they convinced her to stay, and she made her way to the battlefront. And it was a piece of history which was very ugly, unfortunately. But even after the battle, Amir al-Mu'mineen said, the respect and dignity towards Ayesha, we are preserving like day one, as the wife, as the wife of the Holy Messenger, we respect that dignity. In the year 37 after Hijrah was the Battle of Siffin. Now this was also a very ugly battle. It had a lot of repercussions. Even after the battle, it took a long time, around 18 months, and some reports suggest 70,000 people were killed altogether, especially towards the end. And here the battle was against the Qasitin. Qasitin meaning the oppressors, the transgressors. People like Muawiyah, who were not satisfied with the caliphate of Amir al-Mu'mineen and revolted against the caliphate. And Muawiyah had his own territory in Sham, Syria, and was ruling over there and did not accept Amir al-Mu'mineen's caliphate from day one. During the time of the second caliph, Omar, Muawiyah had ruled and was the governor of Sham for 5 years. This was very unusual because Omar never allowed anyone to be a governor for more than a year. Also unusual was Muawiyah had built a very luxurious palace in Sham during his reign as governor. And Omar had reproached many and had penalized many and had punished many who would build a simple house during their governorship. But he was very silent in relation to Muawiyah. This shows that the relationship was very deep and well established. And during the time of Uthman, the third caliph, Muawiyah had continued, and for 12 years he had continued his role as the governor of Sham. So you would imagine that when Amir al-Mu'mineen would come, he would cancel and he would not accept the governorship of someone like Muawiyah. Muawiyah then transgressed and didn't accept this, and started his direct animosity against Amir al-Mu'mineen, which existed before, but during the caliphate of Amir al-Mu'mineen, it had become very serious. And the Battle of Siffin had many injuries, had many fatalities, as I say, some reports suggesting over 70,000, and it ended in a very negative manner with an unfair arbitration. And this arbitration, from each side, they sent their representative, although they weren't accepted representative sent by the side of Amir al-Mu'mineen, until it reached the likes of Abu Musa Ash'ari, and they had deceived him and fooled him. It was a very ugly arbitration because they decided between Abu Musa al-Ash'ari and the representative of Muawiyah that each one should say that their caliph will negate all responsibility and they would put it to the people again. So the representative of Muawiyah did that, Amr al-As, and then the representative of Amir al-Mu'mineen's side, eventually a person who was accepted by Muawiyah's camp was Abu Musa. So he went and said, we've decided to put aside the caliphate of Amir al-Mu'mineen and put it to the vote again. But when Amr al-As came, he said, no, we haven't accepted such a thing, and we believe Muawiyah should continue as caliphate. So they deceived Abu Musa al-Ash'ari. It was a very ugly thing which happened, and because of this unfair arbitration and the manner it was done, the Khawarij, they appeared, a group of people who were all for Amir al-Mu'mineen, but because of the manner that the arbitration was actualized, they became enemies of Amir al-Mu'mineen. So the seeds of the Khawarij, the deserters, the exiters, so to speak literally, it was the seeds were built and formed during the Battle of Siffin, or rather towards the end of the Battle of Siffin. And then in the year 38, the Mariqin are the deserters, so to speak. These people also waged battle against Amir al-Mu'mineen. They were 12,000, around 12,000 in number, but Amir al-Mu'mineen came and spoke with them to prevent a battle. 8,000 of them did return, but 4,000 remained. The battle was a very short battle, only took around a day, and it was an easy victory for Amir al-Mu'mineen, but it was still something which caused a lot of problems, especially after the battle. And that battle was called the Battle of Nahrawan. And it was after the Battle of Siffin, primarily, that Muawiyah sent Busr ibn Abi Artat, who was the head of the so-called destruction army, the destruction machine of Muawiyah's army. Busr was sent with a battalion of over 20,000 people, and he kept on going to different towns and cities, getting, by force, getting the allegiance of people towards Muawiyah as the caliph. And there he killed a lot. He would, you know, align the people of a city, of a town, and kill them one by one. Exactly how Daesh was ruling. They would go from city to city, massacring people. And they would say, who do you pledge allegiance to? If they would say Ali, they would be killed instantaneously. Even if they were to say, when they were told by the army of Busr that give your allegiance, pledge your allegiance to Muawiyah, even if someone was to say to who and ask a question to who, they would be beheaded immediately. So you can just imagine the environment from city to city, getting the pledge of allegiance. And in some books of history, they say that half the cities were, from the beginning of the caliphate of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the number of cities that had pledged allegiance to Amir al-Mu'mineen, half of them, because of the very brutal tactics of Muawiyah, half of these cities were now under Muawiyah's control because of what the army of Busr had actualized through force, through coercion. So this is all just to understand the environment which Imam Hassan alayhi salam had inherited. Three ugly, very detrimental wars. Half of the cities now had changed their pledge, albeit by force. And then it ended with the martyrdom of Amir al-Mu'minin in the year 40 after Hijrah. The activities that Busr had done was in the last year primarily of Amir al-Mu'minin's caliphate. So after the martyrdom, people then, because of the nature of the martyrdom, they did side with Imam Hassan and did give their pledge of allegiance to Imam Hassan in Kufa. Because after the Battle of Jamal, Amir al-Mu'minin moved his headquarters from Medina to Kufa. And in Kufa, they did give their pledge of allegiance to Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Although this wasn't with the same basira and insight that the people had when they had pledged allegiance to Amir al-Mu'minin after Uthman was killed. However, there was some basira, but still, it was also an emotional affair because Amir al-Mu'minin had been martyred in the manner he was martyred. They did flow in Kufa towards Imam Hassan alayhi salam, but it wasn't with that insight which was necessary. Muawiyah had a strong conjecture because of how the supporters of Ali alayhi salam had treated Ali alayhi salam, especially in the Battle of Siffin, when they were easily fooled towards the end of the battle, when Amir al-Mu'minin was about to win. But the army of Muawiyah, through the deception of Amr al-As, had placed Qur'ans on their spears, and many of the followers of Amir al-Mu'minin were not ready to actualize the final blow against the enemy and the army of Muawiyah. So Muawiyah knew that many of the followers were not strong adherents. They weren't loyal. This was manifested before. And now Imam Hassan was the new caliph. Muawiyah wanted to avoid Imam Hassan becoming established in his ways. And before he does become established, he wanted to get rid of the caliphate of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. And therefore, after discussing and getting advice from his counselors, Muawiyah decided that the best way is to start a war with Imam Hassan and fight the army of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. One marginal point which deserves attention is in all the battles of Amir al-Mu'minin, and when we speak of the followers of Amir al-Mu'minin during those battles, they were all Sunni, or the vast majority were Sunni. They weren't Shias. They were Shias in the absolute sense of the word. The literal meaning of Shias means followers. Yes, but theologically, most of them were Sunni. By Sunni, I mean they believed Abu Bakr was the rightful successor to the Holy Messenger. So they would see Amir al-Mu'minin as the fourth caliph. They would see Imam Hassan as the fifth caliph, and they would accept these two as leaders. But theologically, they were Sunni. One has to understand this, that both in the battles and the followers in general, very few were theological Shias who believed that the rightful successor to the Holy Messenger from day one was Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salam. They were a very small minority. Shiism was a very small minority at that time. And this has to be appreciated as we progress here. If you remember in the Battle of Nahrawan, where 8,000 had returned to Amir al-Mu'mineen, as I mentioned before, even many of these people had entered the camp of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. They may have had issue with Amir al-Mu'mineen, with what had happened, but they say, now this is Imam Hassan, we will accept him. So there was a large mix, and we'll speak more about the different classes of people who were under and were following Imam Hassan. But without a doubt, the vast majority were Sunni in the theological sense. How we see Sunnis and Shias today, it wasn't seen like that in those days. It was seen in another light. And therefore, all the Sunnis, they accepted as their leader Amir al-Mu'mineen and Imam Hassan alayhim as-salam. So Muawiyah had decided that we have to get rid of Imam Hassan and his army, so let's start a war. This was something which they had in mind and had firmly decided to enact. Now, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, he had allowed many of the positions which his father had assigned, positions of responsibility, he had allowed many of those people to continue with their posts. In relation to the army of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, he had divided it into three. A third was under the auspices of Ubaydullah ibn Abbas, which was the son of Abbas, the uncle of the Holy Messenger. And here, Ubaydullah had one third of the authority. One third was given to Qais ibn Sa'd, who was a very loyal and remained loyal until the last day, a loyal supporter of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. And a third was under Imam Hassan's direct authority. This classification of the army is important as we progress, inshallah. Now, so the intention was war, and the plan was to wage war with Imam Hassan, so that Imam Hassan doesn't become set in his ways and his governance does not become well established. But as this war was in the making, Muawiyah was practicing, or rather was in the process of accomplishing many plots against Imam Hassan alayhi salam. They first had planned, so waging war was the first course of action. However, at the same time, they were trying to fulfill other aims and objectives that they had through different plots. The first was trying to assassinate Imam Hassan with the help of the aristocracy of Kufa, but they failed in that regard. Then they also sent spies, especially to Kufa and Basra. But these spies were caught. The one in Kufa was caught and brought to Imam Hassan. Imam Hassan alayhi salam sentenced him to death, and then sent a letter to Basra, where Ubaydullah ibn Abbas was, and said, look, there may be spies there, be careful. And there too, the spy in Basra was caught and killed. There were other spies too in other areas, but anyway, the whole plot of espionage was foiled. They weren't successful there. Another plot was to bribe those people in positions of authority, the governors. They were bribing them. In some cases, they were threatening their lives, and therefore they were trying to bring those assigned governors on the side of Muawiyah. And the final category of plots that Muawiyah's camp had accomplished was the dissemination and propaganda of, you know, false rumors. These rumors were, it wasn't like today where one is able then to answer or to have the rumors quashed, so to speak. Although even today this may be sometimes difficult with the vast coverage of media being biased. But you can imagine in those days, once the rumors became established, people would believe it on the whole, and they wouldn't have time to think otherwise, because it would take time for the truth to come out. Especially with Muawiyah's propaganda machine, these rumors were really spreading very fast. Rumors, the main two rumors, or the main two types of rumors that were given, was that they would say X person has been martyred or has died. And that person is someone, a person of authority, and their aim was to weaken the spirits of Imam Hassan's army, alayhi salam. And so they would bring these, you know, rumors so that people would think, oh, now we don't have this important warrior or fighter. What are we going to do? It would weaken the spirits, and that was their aim. Or another rumor was they would keep on saying that Imam Hassan, alayhi salam, has offered a treaty of reconciliation with Muawiyah. And this would also weaken the spirits. And it was a lie. This was never the case. So these were the plots that Muawiyah's camp were enacting and were actualizing. But the first course of action was war. And they were directing all their affairs in this direction, but through these plots. Now, I want to read from a section from Sheikh Mufid's Irshad. Now, it has been translated into English, and with the copy that I have, it's from page 282. I just want to read certain parts of the account of Sheikh Mufid. So after the assassination attempts were foiled and the espionage network had been identified and put an end to, Imam Hassan, after the two spies especially were caught and killed, he wrote a letter to Muawiyah, and he wrote the letter saying that you sent men to use deception and to carry out assassinations, and you sent out spies as if you want to meet in battle. That is something which will soon happen, so wait for it, if God wills. I have learned that you have become haughty in a way that no wise man would become haughty. So here, Imam Hassan knows, and Muawiyah, his plan is that of war. Imam Hassan understands this and says, yes, we will now engage in war against you. If this is what you want, it's what you're going to get. Then later, Sheikh Mufid writes, Muawiyah replied to him with his letter. And then he says, there's no need to mention the letter. And there followed between him, Muawiyah, and Imam Hassan, alayhi salam, different correspondences and messages between the two on different issues. Then Muawiyah set off towards Iraq. When he reached the bridge of Manbij, Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, reacted. He sent Hujr ibn Adi, a very loyal supporter of Imam Hassan, to order the leaders to set out and to call the people together for war. So Muawiyah had reached a certain place, and here Imam Hassan is now preparing the grounds for war, asking Hujr ibn Adi to prepare the people for the war. So war is in the making now. So Hujr ibn Adi went to when to prepare the people and the leaders for such a war, they were slow to answer him. Now imagine those plots, the four classes of plots, were all in the making. All these were happening. So the false rumours were disheartening the army camp of Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Or for example, the bribery and all these things were happening. People were seeing things, were hearing things. So this was really taking its toll upon the army. When Hujr ibn Adi went to do what he was told to do, but the people were slow to answer him. And then they came forward. Imam Hassan had a mixed band of men. Now here Sheikh Mufid is describing the different classes of followers within the camp of Imam Hassan. Some of them belonged to his Shia and to his fathers, the true Shia, the theological Shias of the time, but they were a very small minority. Some of them were members of the Kharijites, the Khawarij, who were active in the Battle of Nahrawan, who went against Imam Ali because of what happened in the Battle of Siffin. But as I said, there were 12,000 in the Battle of Nahrawan, 8,000 returned to their ways. Only 4,000 had continued. Anyway, some of them, out of these 12,000, those who remained alive after the Battle of Nahrawan, some of them, their ideology was we were against Amir al-Mu'mineen. We have no grudges against Imam Hassan. So they did continue. But, you know, look at the caliber and the quality of the followers of Imam Hassan. It wasn't a very strong caliber. So some of them were the Kharijites, the so-called Mariqin, if you remember, who were influenced by the desire of fighting Muawiyah by every means possible. And now it's through Imam Hassan. Some of them were men who loved discord and were anxious for the war booty. It was for materialistic needs that they had entered the war front. Some of them were doubters, but they were still part of the army camp, and others were tribal supporters who followed the leaders of their tribes without reference to religion. So Imam Hassan, he set off until he came to Hammam Omar, a place there. Then he went on to Deir Ka'ab and he stopped in an area district called Sabat, just before the bridge, and spent the night there. Now, this was the bridge, most probably that Muawiyah, the Manbij bridge that he had encountered. And he spent the night there. In the morning, Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, wanted to test his followers, because those plots, especially the rumours and the briberies and the threatening of lives of the governors and many of them returning, going to the enemy camp, the disheartening of the spirits of the camp of Imam Hassan was something Imam Hassan was realizing. So he wanted to test their obedience. And he wanted to make their situation clear with regard to obedience to him, so that in that way he might be able to distinguish his friends from his enemies and be in a clear mind about his position to meet Muawiyah and the Syrians. He ordered the call to be made. The prayer is a general one which all should attend. It was a congregational prayer. They gathered and he went up on the pulpit and addressed them. He said, "Praise belongs to Allah. I testify that there's no God but Allah. I testify that Muhammad is his servant and his apostle, whom he sent with the truth and whom he entrusted with revelation. May God bless him and his family. Then by Allah, I hope that I shall always be with Allah's praise and kindness. I am the sincerest of Allah's creatures in giving advice to them. I have not become one who bears malice to any Muslim, nor one who wishes evil or misfortune for him. Indeed, what you dislike about unity is better for you than what you like about division. I see what is better for you, better than you see for yourselves. Therefore, don't oppose my commands. Don't reject my judgment. May Allah forgive both me and you, and may Allah guide me and you to that in which there is love and divine satisfaction." Then the people began to look at one another when Imam Hassan was saying this. They began to look at one another and asked each other, "What do you think the Imam intends by the words that he's just been saying?" Then some of the people answered, "We think that he intends to make peace with Muawiyah and hand over the authority to Muawiyah." This was because of the rumors that had been passing through the enemy camp. So they said, "Look, he wants to give authority to Muawiyah," and they couldn't. The camp of Imam Hassan, they couldn't accept it. There were many Kharijites there. There were many people who were keen to go to battle for the wrong reasons, even for the war booty or things like that. They couldn't handle the fact, especially with the rumors that had become disseminated. They couldn't hand the passing of authority to Muawiyah. "By Allah, the man has become a kafir, a disbeliever." Look how they're accusing Imam Hassan of being a kafir. The slander here, the way they were reproaching the Imam. "By Allah, the man has become a kafir," they declared, and they rushed towards his tent. They couldn't accept it. Then Sheikh Mufid says they plundered him to the extent that they even took his prayer mat from under him. Then Abdurrahman ibn Abdullah ibn Ja'al al-Azdi set on him and stripped the Imam's silk cloak from his shoulder. He remained sitting, still girt with his sword, but without his cloak. He called for his horse and mounted it. Groups of his close associates and his true Shia surrounded him, his true followers, surrounded him and kept those who wanted to attack him away from him. Suddenly they wanted to get rid of Imam Hassan. Just this, imagining the scene is really terrific. Then he said, "Summon the tribes of Rabi'a and Hamdan to me." He wanted more protection. Otherwise this was going to be the end of Imam Hassan here. And he still hadn't completed the objective he had in mind. They were summoned to him and they surrounded him and defended him, peace be upon him, from the people. A mixed group of others went with him as well. So they managed to take him out and he managed to flee the scene. But when he was passing through the narrow pass of Sabat, a man of Banu Asad called Jarrah ibn Sinan caught hold of the reins of his mule. He had an axe in his hand, Jarrah did, and he cried, "Allahu Akbar, you've become a mushrik," referring to Imam Hassan, "just like your father," referring to Imam Ali, "had become a mushrik." Then he stabbed Imam Hassan in the thigh with the axe. Exactly how Daesh calls everyone a mushrik and keeps on killing people for the most pathetic of reasons. This phenomenon of Daesh has roots in history. It's not anything new. They are continuing that line of Muawiyah. Jarrah stabbed Imam Hassan in the thigh and it penetrated right through to the bone. Then Imam Hassan seized. Then Jarrah seized Imam Hassan by the neck and they both fell to the ground. A man from Imam Hassan's followers called Abdullah ibn Khatal At-Ta'i pulled the axe away from his hand and struck him with it in the stomach and killed Jarrah. Another man called Zubyan ibn Umar attacked him, struck him upon the nose and killed him. So it was Zubyan who killed Jarrah, sorry. The other one just threw him away and had struck him with an axe. Another man who had been with Jarrah was also caught and killed. Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, was carried on a stretcher to Al-Mada'in, Midian, where he was lodged with Sa'd ibn Mas'ud al-Thaghavi. The latter was the governor of Amir al-Mu'mineen there, and Imam Hassan had confirmed him in that position. Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, was distracted by his own discomfort and with treating his wound. In the meantime, a group of the tribal leaders wrote, who were in the camp of Imam Hassan, they secretly wrote to Muawiyah, offering to accept his authority, to listen and obey to Muawiyah. They urged him to come to them, and they guaranteed to hand over Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, when they got to his camp, or to kill him treacherously. Imam Hassan alayhi salam learnt of that when a letter came to him from Qais ibn Sa'd, who had one third of the army under his control. May God be pleased with him. He had sent Qais with Ubaydullah ibn Abbas to go on ahead, and he had set out from Kufa to meet Muawiyah and to drive him out of Iraq and make himself a commander of a unified people. He had said to Ubaydullah ibn Abbas, "If you're struck down, the commander will be with you. Qais ibn Sa'd will be with you." Qais ibn Sa'd's letter arrived informing him that they had stopped Muawiyah at a village called Habubiyyah, opposite Maskan. Then Muawiyah had sent a letter to Ubaydullah ibn Abbas, urging him to come to him and offering him 1,000,000 dirhams, in some reports 2,000,000 dirhams, half of which he would give him immediately and the other half on his entry into Kufa. So Ubaydullah ibn Abbas, who had a third of the army of Imam Hassan under his supervision, was bribed here. Ubaydullah ibn Abbas had slipped away in the night with his close associates to join Muawiyah's camp. He accepted the bribe. In the morning, the people found their leader missing. Ubaydullah was missing. Qais ibn Sa'd, may God be pleased with him, said the prayer with them and took charge of the affairs. So here you can see that after what had happened to Imam Hassan being attacked and him fleeing to the Midian, the one third of the army under Imam Hassan had dispersed. And you saw that even the tribal leaders who were following Imam Hassan, they sent a letter to Muawiyah saying, "Come, we'll be with you." That's one. Then, through the bribes Muawiyah had accomplished in relation to Ubaydullah ibn Abbas, here, Ubaydullah gave in. Now, he was a family member of Imam Hassan. They were a close family. And he gave in to the bribes. Now, you may ask, why would someone like Ubaydullah be given such a position in the first place? Here, the scholars have given different answers, just showing that in writing, he had all the qualifications to be a governor and to have a third of the army under his control. For example, until 10 years of age, Ubaydullah ibn Abbas was always under the auspices of the Holy Prophet. When the Holy Prophet died, Ubaydullah was 10 years of age. Also, Busr ibn Abi Artat, remember the head of the destruction army of Muawiyah, had killed, during his rampaging and pillaging of the different cities, it was most probably in Mecca, when he killed two of the sons of Ubaydullah in the presence of their mother. So Ubaydullah always had a grudge against Busr and Muawiyah. Also, Amirul Mu'mineen had assigned Ubaydullah ibn Abbas as the Amir, the leader of the Hajj caravans, on two particular years. So he was a very trustworthy figure. Then Amirul Mu'mineen also assigned Ubaydullah ibn Abbas as the governor of Yemen and Bahrain during the caliphate of Amirul Mu'mineen. Ubaydullah also was one of the very first supporters of Imam Hassan after the martyrdom of Amirul Mu'mineen. And Imam Hassan had always assigned very good, professional, strong advisors for Ubaydullah, just in case he would err, the likes of Qais ibn Sa'd. So given all that, you would imagine in writing he would be an ideal person of authority for Imam Hassan alayhi salam, but in the plot of bribes and bribing different governors, and they managed to bribe many governors, but this was a big blow because a third of the army had already gone and dispersed because of what happened to Imam Hassan, that third which was under Imam Hassan alayhi salam. Now with this, another third had dispersed. So all that now remains is the one third of the army of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, which was under Qais ibn Sa'd, who was loyal until the end. Now, Imam Hassan had done everything so that these governors or the military leaders would never become susceptible to such bribes. He would even increase their wages, double their wages. You know, and even when they had reached such a level where 2/3 of the army, he still wouldn't accept any terms of reconciliation. The war was to happen. He was adamant that we're not going to give in. We have to defeat Muawiyah. And even though Muawiyah had sent people to Imam Hassan, so Imam Hassan accepts a treaty of reconciliation, a truce of some sort, Imam Hassan would reject them and say no. Even until the later stages, he would still say no. Although the way the rumors were disseminated, it was as if Imam Hassan was asking for a treaty of reconciliation from the beginning. This was all rubbish. So all that was left was the 1/3 under Qais. And even though the army had diminished, 2/3 of it had diminished, here Imam Hassan wrote a letter to Qais and say, look, you remain where you are, control your people, we'll join you. I'm going to join you. I'm recovering, I'm in Sabat, but I'll be joining you soon. But keeping Qais was loyal until Qais himself was loyal until the very end. But keeping the unified force between his army soldiers proved to be too difficult because of the rumors, and that they became dispersed sooner or later also. And it was under such circumstances that Imam Hassan was forced into a truce. Because if he hadn't accepted the truce, first of all, it was only until the very last stages that he would accept it, not from the beginning. It was only when there was really no other choice, and we'll come to what the incentives were in ultimately accepting the truce. But it was a forced, coerced truce, but he made maximum advantage out of it. And the way he made advantage out of it proved to be very important, and he was laying the scaffolding to the movement of Karbala later. Going back to Kitabul Irshad, So Imam Hassan's awareness of the people's desertion of him increased, as did his awareness of the corrupt intention of the Kharijites against him, which they made obvious by cursing him, accusing him of being a kafir, declaring that it was lawful to shed his blood and plunder his property. All this was happening. There remained no one to protect Imam Hassan from his unfortunate predicament, except the very close associates from his father's followers and his own followers, the true Shias. And they were a group which could not resist the Syrian soldiers, even amongst them. Many of them, they couldn't resist, and they said, look, it's a no-go area now. Until when are we going to continue with this? Muawiyah wrote to him about a truce and peace treaty. This was X number of times, but this one, at this stage, he again wrote a letter. He also sent him the letters of Imam Hassan's own followers, in which they had guaranteed to kill Imam Hassan treacherously or to hand him over. Muawiyah offered him as many conditions as Imam Hassan wanted to answer his call for peace, although maybe reconciliation is a better word to be used here, and he gave his sworn covenant by whose fulfillment everybody's interests would be served. Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, didn't trust him. He was aware of Muawiyah's deception and his attempts at assassinating him. However, he can find no escape from assenting to his demands to abandon the war and bring about a truce because of the weakness of his followers. Understanding of his right, their corrupt attitude towards him, and their opposition to him. So this was a forced truce. There were no true followers left. Then I'll mention a hadith on this in a minute. So in addition, Imam Hassan alayhi salam was aware of the view of many of them. They were declaring it was lawful to shed Imam Hassan's blood and to hand him over to his rival. He also knew of his cousin's deserting him, Ubaydullah ibn Abbas. and joining the enemy camp, as well as the inclination of the people towards the immediate present and their reluctance to show concern for the future. Therefore, he, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, bound himself in a treaty with Muawiyah as a result of the confirmation of the proof of his situation and with the excuses before Allah the Most High and all the Muslims of what had taken place among them. His Kitab al-Irshad is a very worthy read. It's one of the authentic accounts of history. It bears a very strong degree of authenticity. Okay, so as you can imagine, the environment was getting really tense. And so this truce was really, there was no other alternative. When it comes to the incentives behind accepting this truce, Imam Hassan alayhi salam has mentioned a number of them. First, he said they would have killed Imam Hussein and all the close associates, the close true followers, like Imam Hussein, like Hazrat Abbas, also the son of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and other close, they would have killed all of them if Imam Hassan hadn't accepted the truce. So this was something which had to be done, because according to Nahjul Balagha, one of the responsibilities of an Imam is to preserve the succeeding Imam. For example, Imam Sajjad, the fourth Imam, wasn't allowed to go in the battle and participate in the Battle of Karbala. Imam Hussein had to protect the interests of imamat, of successorship. And so here, Imam Hassan had to protect the interests of Imam Hussein, alayhi salam. It's a duty of every imam to protect the life of the succeeding imam. Also, Shiism, as we know it, and the theological Shiism, and the true followers, the true Shias of the time, they would have all been killed. Shiism would have become extinct. It was a minority even at that time, but they would have easily become extinct. They would have blocked all economic means to the Shias. And Imam Hassan knew that the followers weren't loyal. The vast majority weren't loyal. After the plots of Muawiyah, the success of the plots of Muawiyah, he knew that I'm left with no one. And therefore he had to accept it. When it comes to he had to accept it because he was scared that, you know, all his followers were going to die and Islam was going to be a recipient of a very major blow. When it comes to the stipulations he made in the truce, this worked in favor of Islam and Shiism. He said Muawiyah will hold the power of governance on the condition that, and he made 7 or 8 conditions. One was that on the condition that he acts upon the Quran and the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet and the normative conduct of the righteous caliphs. Second, that when he dies, the power of governance has to shift to Imam Hassan, and if something was to happen to Imam Hassan, would have to shift to Imam Hussein. This was also a clear stipulation, and it was clearly stipulated too that Muawiyah should not assign any successor. Now Muawiyah went against all of these. But this, when Muawiyah went against all of these, the people slowly but surely, they realized that the haq was on the side of Imam Hassan. They realized through these stipulations that Muawiyah had fooled them. Another was that any blasphemy or cursing against Amir al-Mu'mineen, which had become normal during the qunut of the Salat, must be abandoned. The security of all the Shias have to be maintained, and that their interests shouldn't be trampled upon. Their lives, their honours, their lands, they shouldn't be usurped. And another stipulation was there shouldn't be any conspiracy made against or any plots made against Imams Hassan and Imam Hussein. And Muawiyah shouldn't be called Amir al-Mu'mineen. And maybe one or two other stipulations. But these worked in the favor of Islam in the longer term, because people would realize the evil nature of Muawiyah more and more. Muawiyah wasn't like his son Yazid, who would blatantly go against Islam. He was much more behind the curtains. He would plan a lot of evil things, but he would do it all indirectly, so people don't attribute things to him. Even he said, I don't want to kill Imam Hassan myself. We have to brainwash the followers of Imam Hassan in a way that they themselves kill Imam Hassan. Otherwise, I don't want the blood of Imam Hassan to be attributed to me. See, he was very conniving in this sense. And therefore, this was the main reason that this truce was accepted, but it was coerced. There was no other alternative. But Imam Hassan from the beginning was adamant on the war to destroy Muawiyah and his camp. And he did everything he could. Even towards the end, where two-thirds of the army had dispersed, he still was adamant that this has to go ahead. Now, we have traditions that in Qiyamah, it said, for example, Aina hawariyu Zain al-Abidin? Where are the disciples of the true followers of Imam Sajjad? And some people will stand up in Qiyamah. Or for example, Aina hawariyu Hussein ibn Ali? Where are the disciples of Hussein ibn Ali? For example, the 72 Shaheed and others, they will rise and say, we are the true followers, disciples. It was us. But when it comes to Aina hawariyu Hassan ibn Ali, only two people stand. And one of those two, first of all, only two, and look at the quality of these two. One of them was Sufyan ibn Abi Layla. And he was very loyal to the end. But when the truce was accepted, he looked in the face of Imam Hassan alayhi salam and said, Assalamu alaykum ya mudhillal mu'mineen. That peace be upon you, O debaser, humiliator of the believers. This is a so-called true follower until the very end. Even people like Hujj ibn Adi had criticized the Imam and said, why did you accept the truce? The Imam said, look, I had to accept it. Hujj would say that, why did you accept it? We should have gone until the very end. Imam replied, Hujj, you don't know these people. They would have destroyed everyone. What I did was more rewarding in Allah's eyes, more rewarding than the extent of the reward was more than whatever the sun sets upon or shines upon from sunrise to sunset. But even the likes of these people, they reproached Imam Hassan alayhi salam. And years later, just look, years later, this mentality of Muawiyah's enemy camp continued. The Busr ibn Abi Artat mentality continued today in the form of Daesh. And look, Daesh had excavated the grave of Hujr ibn Adi and really broke the sanctity of that grave. Years later, a lot can be said here. But here we see Imam Hassan was suppressed so much, maybe much more than the other imams. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, I'll end here, has two speeches in this regard. He says the amount of bother and inconvenience Imam Hassan had received from his friends and companions was more than that received from others. The companions were not attentive to the basis through which the Imam of their time is endeavouring and planning. with their petty imaginations and deficient thoughts, they had stood up against the Imam, inconveniencing him and even pillaging him. As I say, they took off his clothing, his cloak, they called him a kafir, and so on and so forth. Also, Imam Khomeini has said, Imam Hassan executed and continued with the uprising as long as it was feasible. He would increase the wages of the military leaders. He would, even though two-thirds of the army were all scattered, he would still continue until the very end, even when he was injured. When he was hindered, when Imam Hassan was hindered to go forward and continue with the uprising, he committed himself to the reconciliation and disgraced Muawiyah. Imam Hassan disgraced Muawiyah to the same extent Yazid was disgraced by Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So this was something that had to happen. The very core of Shiism was under attack. And now today, who is the Muawiyah of today, in present times? There's no need for me to enter the particularities. You can easily ascertain who the Muawiyah of today's times are. Then the question is this, O Muslims, are you seeking refuge under the Muawiyahs of today? Are you supporting the Muawiyahs of today directly or indirectly? Is your money going into the army of today's Muawiyahs? What are you doing? Who is the, in quotes, Imam Hassan of the time? Are you doing anything to support Imam Hassan's revolution today? Or are you silent? And your silence is promoting the Muawiyah regime of today. People are very comfortable with their lives under despotic leaders. We have to think about and re-evaluate our lives. We're only going to be alive for 70, 80, 100 years. We have to do our maximum to become Hassani, our souls to become Hassani in nature. Only two people at that time amongst the companions of Imam Hassan rose. But we have to be amongst the people who'd rise for Imam Hassan in the hereafter, amongst the followers after the generation of Imam Hassan. And when you look at the story here, no wonder the likes of Imam Khomeini said that the followers, my followers in the Islamic Revolution, especially during the early parts of the Islamic Revolution, he said, those who are following me, their iman is more than the companions of the Prophet, the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the companions of Imam Hassan. Because these people, even though they never saw their imams, but they were always obedient to me, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. Now we have to show that commitment and obedience, otherwise we'll be resurrected with the likes of the army of Muawiyah. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammad wa ala tahirin.